It dates back to an article about cafe society published in Fortune magazine in the late 30s. There was a photograph of an elegant couple in a nightclub with the caption, "They want to be amused." Jay Landsman says when he read that, he knew what he wanted to do with his life, go into the business of amusing the chronically bored. So in the late 40s, Landsman set about combining business and pleasure. He became part owner of a hip night spot in St. Louis, then opened his own nightclub where those looking for something out of the mainstream could see performers like Lenny Bruce, Nichols and May, and the Smothers Brothers. Landsman also published a literary journal called Neurotica, where you could find the early works of writers like Allen Ginsberg, Marshall McLuhan, and John Cleland Holmes. There's a new paperback edition of Landsman's memoir, Rebel Without Applause. I spoke to him from the NPR Bureau in London. He's lived in London since the mid-60s. He described the atmosphere he created in his clubs.
I started Little Bohemia on the waterfront of St. Louis by the banks of the river, and it was a sort of an artist's place that displayed paintings from local artists, and you sold drinks. It was the first time a club ever sold drinks and had paintings on the wall other than cutouts from the Police Gazette. And so that was my first attempt at it. It was a very, very successful attempt at it. And then I went on to do the next club I did was the Crystal Palace, which was a small boite in a very unattractive part of town. And we made it into a little gem of a club, and we had just a lot of fun. It was a permanent party.
Now, you also edited a journal called Neurotica.
Yes.
Which you described as a literary explosion and defense of the problems and personalities that in our culture are defined as neurotic. Why was neurosis the focus of a literary magazine for you?
Well, there were a lot of literary people. There was a time when all the activity, everything was under analysis, and particularly the literary personalities of 19th century, 20th century, and the criticism seemed to center around their psychoanalytic interpretation of why they wrote this and what they were really saying. And that's why Neurotica was interested in the literary aspect of it.
You wrote that you thought neurotic culture was actually turning
neurotic,
people into neurotic.
In those days, neurotic didn't have the same connotation that it does today. If you weren't neurotic in 1948 or 1950 in America, you didn't find any friends. I mean, it was a very lonely life not to be neurotic. Neurotic was a very hip thing to be in those days. But the shift of as we got to know better about the neurotic personality, we began to understand it a little better. It ceased to be as attractive as it once was.
When you were editing Neurotica, one of the writers you published was John Cleland Holmes, and you say that the piece of his that you printed, you think that it was the first piece of published fiction to use the language of the hipster. Yet at the same time, you were really alienated by Kerouac and Ginsberg. It seems you were really...
No, I wasn't alienated. No, that's not true. I wasn't alienated. I was bored by them.
Uh-huh.
Kerouac was... wit was not one of his favorite... qualities, nor Ginsberg either. Ginsberg I had to ward off because, I mean, he used to come up to me with his journals and say to print this and print that and have a look at him. I never even looked at any of them because I knew he was a wacko back then. And so it was, they were really nothing in the scene at that time, and nobody thought they'd ever amount to anything. But then look at that. Here I am in Islington, and they're myths. So how do you figure that?
It seems to me you were so in the middle.
Bitter?
Well, no, that you were so in the middle. You know, on the one hand, you saw yourself as being very anti-establishment and creating these hip joints for the rich. On the other hand, you were really alienated or bored by, as you put it, by these leading beat writers.
Yeah, beat writers were very boring, and beat writers, their contribution to American literary culture has been very limited. I mean, Kerouac is published in 27 languages, and his books still sell. Ginsberg is the subject of a 1,200-page biography and all that. That's all very nice, but what did they really contribute to the cultural, to the understanding of the scene? Very little. Very little. Negative.
Well, you're entitled to your opinion.
yes, I am.
You wrote a Broadway show called The Nervous Set, based on your novel of the same name, and it had music by Tommy Wolfe, lyrics by your wife, Fran Landsman. You describe it as characterizing the intellectual life of the time. What was it you wanted to show in the story?
Well, I wanted to send them up, mostly. It was all about Kerouac and Ginsberg and those people, and I wanted to show that the Beat Generation that the media had grabbed onto from about 1957 to 1959 was, you know, just a media event. It had no significance and no meaning, and it just was, you know, just a fake revolt. That's what the Beat Generation was all about. It was just all completely fake. And what Kerouac and Ginsberg and Corso and all those people did is they just said a lot of nasty words, and they put together a thing. Although I will want to say this in defense of Ginsberg. He did write a great two great poems. One of them was Howl and the other was Kaddish, and I respect him for that. But I don't respect him now and for what he's done and the way he's handled things throughout his life.
In the original cast, Larry Hagman played the character based on Kerouac.
Yes. And he did it in a Southern voice that he uses now in JR. You know, Kerouac was with me when that opened up on when our show opened up on Broadway. I had a hard time getting him into the theater because he was so drunk. And then finally, when he got into the theater and the curtain came up and the show started, he went right to sleep. And he didn't wake up until there was a line on it that said in one of the songs in Fun Life, Shakespeare was a hack, so we read Kerouac. He woke up as the mention of his name, and he turned to me and he said, "Good show, Jay," and went back to sleep. He didn't come back for the second act, though.
You're a pretty self-made guy in some ways, right? I mean, you even made up your first name.
Yes, I made it up after I read The Great Gatsby. I said, well, Jay's the name for me, and after all, I couldn't be called Irving all my life, could I?
What was wrong with Irving?
What was right about it? Can you imagine me going up to a girl and saying, "May I buy you a drink? My name is Irving." You can't do it. They'd never accept it.
You were creating a life in Bohemia, and part of the life you created was, you know, running these nightclubs. So you had to be a businessman in Bohemia.
Yes.
And I was
true.
Wondering if that ever put you in some awkward
not
positions.
Not many Bohemians ever graduated into the capitalist class. In fact, most Bohemians are anti-capitalist. Well, I wasn't. I wanted to be able to do the things I wanted to do, and in order to do that, I had to play their game. I had to get out and do the things that were required, and still retain the amount of freedom that I enjoyed.
Tell me why you ended up moving to England.
Well, as our reign came to an end in the 60s, about 1964, we realized that satire, which was the basis of my whole experience there in the club, we used to do the plays, and we used to do the reviews, and we used to do the productions, and they were all highly tinged with satire. Well, in 1964, satire had gone out of fashion, and the Vietnam War, inner-city blight, and entertaining sing-alongs, well, it just... came up, and suddenly I was out of style, and so when I realized that, I left St. Louis, and I left America because it wasn't I had nothing more to contribute to it, and America had nothing more for me. So I came over to England for a year on a talent tune-up, as the newspaper said at the time, and ended up living here. My children all grew up here, and I've had a good time.
Did you feel more in style in London than you did in America?
Well, I was very happy here at the beginning because England was a place that I'd always dreamed about. I mean, it was really, it was swinging London, wasn't it, in 1965 suddenly. And I found myself hanging out with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and dinner with the Beatles, and it wasn't all bad.
Another interesting part of the world that you helped create was it was a part of the world that combined an element of bohemianism with wealth and sophistication and glamour. I mean, let's face it, a lot of bohemians were really broke.
Yeah, well, I didn't know any broke bohemians. Most of the bohemians that I knew were rather rich. It's sort of like people who, liberals in New York, you know, who talk about Chile and Paraguay and all those countries that are under dictatorships. You know, they can talk about those people, but they're just what they're called over here the chattering classes, champagne socialists or champagne liberals. They're really insignificant, and they really haven't got the right idea on it at all. But that's another question. Let's don't get into that.
So, Jay Landsman, are you living a fun life?
Can I put it to you this way?
Yeah.
I managed to take the sting out of success and put the fun back in failure. I think that's a good one to wrap it up on.
Oh, it's fine. Jay Landsman's memoir, Rebel Without Applause, is published by Paragon House. This is Fun Life from the musical The Nervous Set.
Let's just have fun. Let's not be serious. Play it for laughs. Let's just be cheerious. Everybody knows the human race has lost its reason. Let's just talk clothes and what we're gonna drink this season. Let's dig the scene and have our fling with it. Because we're young, let's ding-a-ling with it. Let's not fret and fuss, 'cause all we've got is us. Baby, let's just have fun. Let's just have fun, let's not be serious. Play it for laughs, let's just be cheerious. We don't give a damn.
This is Fresh Air.